The concept of romanticism is an interesting one. It's just one tradition to actually talk about nature. But romanticism is a problematic prism because it's a prism which somehow separates our species from the rest. In my work, I'm reacting against this idea of separation.
Says Julien Charrière. The Berlin-based artist was born to a French mother and a Swiss father on the bank of Lake Geneva in 1987 and studied with Olafur Eliasson, has had a remarkable career, including prestigious international prizes and awe-inspiring projects, incredible research travels and shows. His greatest exhibition to date, Controlled Burn, at the Langen Foundation in Neuss, is running from September 4th to August next year. It contains major works from his career, as well as 8 new projects, including one setting the famous Tadao Ando Bild Museum on fire. So I'm very happy to talk with Julien Charrière today. And my first question is the name of our podcast, Was macht die Kunst? What is art up to, Julien Charrière? What are you up to these days while you set up the show at the Langen Foundation?
Well, thanks for having me here. Actually, a lot of things are up to and up in the air. I'm just in the middle of install right now. Not the middle, actually, the end of install of the show at the Langen Foundation. But I just came back from California, where I opened a solo presentation at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, titled Erratic, which was kind of like articulate around a video work called Two Hearts, No Earthly Pole, which the museum acquired, and we have like this exhibition which is around this piece. And actually Sunday is going to be the big opening here in Neuss by Düsseldorf in the Langen Foundation. And 2 days after, I'm actually installing in Lyon for the Lyon Biennale. So I have to say it was kind of like a very heavy and stressful summer, and I'm extremely happy the way it went, but I also look forward to have it behind my back.
The title of the exhibition is Controlled Burn. So who is controlling this burn?
Well, maybe we could have put like a question mark at the end of the title, but Controlled Burn, for me, it really referred to 2 things. I mean, it referred to a lot of different things, but the 2 main things that I address with this title is first, the controlled burn of the combustion engine. We have been actually hiding fire. So since the Industrial Revolution, we actually sequestrate the fire and try to hide it in mechanism. And those mechanisms are producing, you know, like the energy and movement that we need in order to propulse the society the way we are doing it today. And on the other hand, the controlled burn also refers to a prescribed burning, which involves setting a plant fire in order to maintain the health of a particular ecosystem, a particular landscape. There's a great tradition of controlled burn, which actually have a positive effect on a particular landscape. And actually a lot of landscape, and we tend to forget about that, need fire in order to regenerate, in order to be healthy. Some of the plants from some of forests need fire in order to reproduce. So fire is actually inherent to the landscape. And what is interesting, fire history and the history of humankind is very intricate somehow, is weaved together. And the fire allowed us to reach places that we couldn't, but we also allowed the fire to reach places that it couldn't. And therefore, like, I think that the full show is kind of looking into this history of fire, but maybe more than fire, the history of fuel. Because there is no fire without fuel. And today we're actually digging deep down into the Earth's crust in order to get more fuel. And what we're doing is we are basically burning out former biomes in form of coal or oil or other like fossil fuel. And while doing that, we unleash the ghost of a former atmosphere, and we reenact somehow the chemical composition of former atmosphere. And that's something which is very much at the core of this exhibition. The momentum where we as a species start to cook stone, basically, and play with fire.
You are going deep down under the surface of the earth with your research, and you are in a whole area with coal that, that of course has a tradition of coal mining. Is that something that you picked up for this particular show?
Well, you never picked up something for a particular show. When I'm starting to think about an exhibition, a particular museum, I'm trying to look at the context of the place. And obviously, the Langen Foundation is a former NATO silo for nukes, for atomic weapons during the Cold War. So on one hand, that's kind of like something which is linked to my work, because I've been visiting two former atomic test sites, one in Kazakhstan, in Semipalatinsk, and one that almost everybody knows, which is the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. So there is like the first piece of the show is actually one of the pictures of Bikini. On the other hand, and that's what you say, which is very interesting, we are in the middle of energy landscape. And if you look westwards from the museum, you really have like the view of like some of the biggest open pit mine, like brown coal, lignite brown coal mining, one of the biggest in Europe. And on the other hand, if you look in the other direction, there's like a field of windmills. So you really have this presence of energy production. And at the same time is also the region with Köln, Deutz, one of the regions where really like the combustion engine have been developed, you know, and not like invented, but developed. And I think that that was something which for me, I wanted to involve. I mean, I didn't do the work for the Langen, but obviously the context of the museum to a certain extent dictate which work I decide to display. And close discussion, obviously, with two curator and collaborator, Delia Hanna and Nadim Saman. We really try to look at my work through the prism of fire, so take the flame as a lens and kind of reread some of the work that I've been doing in the last 10 years. And then obviously also like the creation of new work, which were basically coming out of this substrate.
So the flame, the fire is, of course, for mankind ambivalent. It's on one hand, it's destruction. On the other hand, it's renewal, or it's also possibilities. You mentioned the combustion engine before. What does the ambivalence of the flame mean to you?
The ambivalence of the flame means for me, I don't know if it means anything for me, but I think that, you know, like Bachelard, which was kind of a visionary, made this book, Psychoanalysis of Fire. And on top of, and in this book, on top of like really seeing that fire represent the ultimate image of transformation, like somehow with this idea of destruction and genesis, is also addressing the fact that even image production, so the very fact of like the birth of an image is bound with fire, and is bound with fire from like the very beginning of the history of humankind, with the, you know, we needed the fire in order to draw, we needed the fire in order to see, in order to express ourselves. And then it's like a huge history of image making, which is always come back to the fire in form of flashes, in form of electricity. So this is something which I found extremely interesting and I was trying to address in this show. First of all, there is no human without fire. I mean, I'm not talking about just society, I'm just even talking about physiognomy. We evolve due to the fact that we domesticate the fire, or the fire domesticates us. And then obviously this fascination for the fire, which is kind of like the very first spectacle. I don't know if you can remember the kind of very, very first bonfire that you encounter, like the dancing flame, the dream, but at the same time, you know that the fire is actually hot and you can burn yourself. You have, so that's maybe the ambivalence you're talking about.
You've worked with many materials before, with sculpture, with film, with photography. Do you consider fire a material for your art?
Let's put it like this. I didn't do any work really made out of fire. At this moment where really you will encounter a fire, a real fire from a scientific perspective, like fire is a chemical process rather than a material, obviously. And in the context of art, a chemical process can become a medium. So maybe it's more a medium than a material. But eventually what I found very fascinating and interesting is to kind of play with all this different fire, because like we know we're going to be talking about fire for the next 45 minutes, but there is a plethora of different fire and different fire art. And in the exhibition, you will encounter a few of them, like from this kind of like primordial fire, the Atomic Fire, which basically is a recreation from what happened on the sun's surface, but on Earth, right? With the very first like atom testing, we will have like a burning engine. We might have a controlled burn actually, but we also encounter a fountain set in flame. And I think there's only one work where fire is actually there, and they're like a set of three diptychs, and each of these diptychs, it's a reflective plate. It's a photography made with tar that I extracted in the tar sand of Alberta in North Canada. I don't know if you remember the Alberta wildfire, which was like the biggest and most destructive kind of wildfire of the last 10 years. Eventually, I did this like petro photography, and in front of each of them, there's a candle. And you don't see the candle because it's encapsulated, but you actually will be able to see the reflection of the flame into the picture. So there is actually fire in the show. But I'm not have been working with fire yet. I think you tell it before. So I'm trying actually to work on a performance, a controlled fire, and I'm closely working with Professor Johan Goldhammer, who is a fire ecologist affiliated to the Max Planck Institute. We are proposing to do a controlled burn, a cultural burn around the museum, as a healing principle for the landscape surrounding the museum. And we wanted to do it even maybe for the opening at the beginning, but due to the drought and the situation in Germany right now, it's absolutely impossible. And that's it's kind of like an interesting twist, because in a lot of my work, I sometimes go outside to strange places which are maybe not that easy to reach, and some people seem to be dangerous, but eventually this kind of going out of its own comfort zone, you don't need to go to Bikini anymore. You can just stay here in Europe. And we had to learn it this summer with like the wildfire in France and the drought and the Loire, which don't have water. And like, it's just the erratic reality is here, is not the periphery anymore.
But I just want to mention, some of your trips have been really spectacular. I read that you were part of an expedition in northern Greenland, and you found the northernmost island on Earth.
Yeah, that's true. But it was actually, it's also the most modest discovery, because we were not aiming to go and find new territories in the fashion of the explorator of the 19th century. We were actually trying to collect data about climate change and life at the extremes. And I was with an expedition of a joint venture of Swiss polar scientists and Danish polar scientists. And I was very happy to be invited. And actually, while going to a place that they knew and which was recorded in order to gather sample and data about the northern tip of the Earth, we actually discover a new island. And obviously, it's quite a sad story, because this island was discovered because obviously the pack ice, which have been melting. And when the pack ice is not there, then you see the island once you fly over. And we thought it was another one. And actually, it's only later on that the nice or like the funny thing about this story is that I was not aware. So we thought it was another place. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, when we came back, and I was already in Berlin, and I had to wake up and you know, I'm scrolling Guardian up, as I'm normally doing in the morning, and found like this article of Swiss and Danish scientists discovered the northern island in the world, and then scrolling and just see photo by Julien Charrière. And so I was not even aware. It's a funny story, basically. During this trip, I actually released, I did this performance that you can actually see here at the Langen Foundation. It's called Pure Waste. And this performance, I am releasing 5 carat of diamond into a glacier mill, like one of these blue holes where all the meltwater from the ice cap is basically disappearing. And actually that's the piece is in the show here. It's just this is a little video documentation of this action. The action is interesting because for almost a year and a half, I actually collect first CO2 over the ice cap with direct air capture technology, which is developed by some Swiss scientists, at the Polytechnical University. Dr. Aldo Steinfeld was head of this department. With the help of him, I was able to kind of mine the sky over the ice cap in order to retrieve CO2. And as the pandemic came, we're not able to travel anymore. And I had to rethink or re-reflect, like, first Spatzker piece, as I was trying to do, but also like the way we engage with air as kind of like a medium we go through, but also which goes through us. And as people were not allowed to leave their house and leave the city, go over the border, I actually start to ask them to send me balloon filled with their exhalation. And from this 1,000 exhalation, I isolate the carbon, and with this carbon, I create these diamonds. So they're synthetic diamond made out of carbon, which were exhalated by over 1,000 people during the pandemic. And this diamond, I brought them to the ice cap and throw them in this hole as kind of like a sacrifice or an act of reconciliation, of, you know, like kind of like an allegory for closing the carbon cycle we open.
Do you see yourself in the tradition of romanticism?
Not at all, actually. I would say that, you know, like the concept of romanticism is an interesting one. It's just one tradition, one way to actually talk about nature. And there have been a lot of other way to define nature. There have been land art, bio art. I mean, it's just like it's a prism again. But romanticism is problematic prism because it's a prism which somehow separate our species from the rest. And this separation, it's at the core of a lot of the issue that we encounter today, that we never think we belong, you know, to environment. And even like the words that we use, surrounding, environment, Umwelt, it's never actually taking us within it. We are centered at the center, or we are at the periphery, but the things surround us, we're not part of it. And I think that that's a huge problem, and we need to kind of find new words, maybe habitat, because a habitat is a place that is shared by a lot of different species. And I think that in my work, I'm reacting against this idea of separation. There's some pieces that are really directly made in order to kind of like recalibrate this prism when I climb onto the iceberg and try to melt it down in Iceland in 2013. It was really with this idea to actually go against like an image that we inherit from Caspar David Friedrich, basically, where the human being is aside, and you know, you have this kind of sublime image of nature, which is overwhelmingly powerful and dwarf the persona into the picture. So I put the human figure on the center of the picture, but on the iceberg, melting the ice under its own feet. And then I think that most of the work that I'm doing, and a lot which you will encounter here in the show, they're actually addressing this new way of seeing and also giving a voice to different agencies and different agents. So basically here, an example would be the Penkronic Garden, which is one of the new work proposed for the Langen Foundation. That's actually a garden where plants from the Carboniferous era are growing in the dark. They're growing in a near infrared light. Penkronic species is basically a species which didn't disappear through evolution, but went through time. Meaning, in this case, we have cycads, we have fern, we have palm fern, and these are species which were already around 300 million years ago. And these plants, they've been equipped with different sensor, and this sensor obviously record plant activity. They record plant feeling, if you can talk about feeling, but plants are sentient. Plants have a nervous system, we know it, and we know that the plant feel once you touch one of its leaves, but it's very difficult for us human to create kind of like an emotional bridge towards a plant. Is much easier to understand a dog, right? But to understand a tree is much more complicated. But in this particular garden that I'm proposing, plants or like the activity will be translated in sound and light, and you will actually be able to encounter these activities through something that you can sense, through, you know, like sounds. And these sounds are actually made by the plant itself, or they're made by the surrounding of a plant, but record it through the plants. So that's what I wanted to say. Or generally, I think that, you know, like generally, when I actually think of a show, I'm trying to not just exposing object, but also seeing that the viewer is also exposed to the object. So we have a relationship. It's not like I'm actually putting a big erratic boulder in the middle of the museum and that's kind of static. The erratic boulder is also sensing the presence of us, or of the viewers. At the end, there is an exchange all the time. And this exchange, I mean, with a boulder is more complicated, but with a plant, when you actually exhale, the plants inhale, meaning that your respiration become, you know, plant material. So it's a very direct kind of like action-reaction link.
You have been working with nature, it seems like forever. I have a question. When you were a child, did you prefer science or did you prefer art in school?
I think I like both a lot. I mean, as I was a child, I was a lot outside. I was bird watching, fishing, but I was also drawing and building things. So I always have been into kind of both fields. And at school, it depends on what time in school, right? But probably a little later on, I was more into the art than in the science. So
when I first heard your name, that was about 10 years ago, you and Julius von Bismarck had a project in Venice at the Architecture Biennial called Some Pigeons Are More Equal Than Others. And I thought this was also, I mean, in a way, it touches the same nerve. You take something overlooked, a pigeon, and everybody thinks pigeons are awful in Venice because they shit all over the place and destroy the Romanesque structures and architecture. You colored the pigeons. So there were pigeons flying around that were green, blue, orange, and all of a sudden they had this exotic and even beautiful, like a parakeet or something. You would think there's an exotic bird flying, but it was just one of these pigeons that are usually just shooed away, except for some people, of course, who feed them on St. Mark's Square. How did that project come about? Does that come perfectly in line with the tradition of the works you're doing now?
Yeah, I think so. But that was at the moment where I was very interested into pigeons. And I was interested into pigeons because pigeons are obviously they're birds, right? Everybody knows that. But also they're somewhat cyborgs because they've been, you know, like trained as a communication medium for very, very long. So they were the iPhone or smartphone from the time, right? And somehow, at a certain moment, we didn't need it, the pigeon anymore. And these pigeons start to populate our cities and use our infrastructure in another way, a way they were not planned for, because they recognize in our building the cliffs where they were normally nesting in their natural habitat. And so they were this kind of like ambivalent being, domesticated, trained, changed, and that at the same time being free again, but not going back to a natural habitat, but using a city or like seeing in the city a cliff, a canyon, a landscape, and being able to nest within it. And that's something that I found striking. And I did like a few different pieces with Pigeon. And then together with Julius, we actually develop this piece, Some Pigeons Are More Equal Than Others, which was first debuted in Copenhagen, but then really big for the Venice Architecture Biennale, actually. And the title of the show, which was created by Chipperfield, was Common Ground. And this idea of a common ground of a city, but then the idea that you don't have only one species using it, but many, that was very important. And we wanted to kind of like put a focus on this pigeon, because these birds are mistreated, they're hated, they're killed, as you said, but they have like, they're quite smart, and they can recognize human quite well. They have a better face recognition ability than a child of 3-4 years old, right? And therefore, when you're having your coffee and the pigeon is coming, maybe he saw you before and it's just coming back because he liked you. That's something that you don't understand, because we just see them as like a gray kind of mass of flying rats, right? Even though I love them, but that's another story. Putting color on them make them visible in another way. So on one hand, you hack the reality of everyone, because if you put a red bird onto San Marco or, you know, in Copenhagen, then people are obviously first shocked and destabilized because they're not expecting it. But at the end of the day, it's just one color that you change, but it can really flip the kind of like urban landscape you're looking at. And on another hand, it also gives the possibility to people which are using the urban landscape in their daily life to actually create a relationship to a specific bird. Because if the red bird is every day on the bench or next to the bench where you're sitting and having a cigarette, then you kind of understand, okay, this bird before was gray, but it was also there. And so you start to have like another kind of encounter between species, which we thought was very interesting. And on the other hand, if you knew that pigeon have been colored in your city, then you will start to look at the cityscape in a very different way. You will start to look up. You will start to actually try to see through the eyes of a pigeon. You will try to understand, oh, where this pigeon could be. So you will actually project yourself into the reality of a pigeon within the particular city where it was painted, which actually, again, give you the possibility to extract yourself from like your daily life and re-encounter a reality through another prism, which I think is one of the basic things that art should or could do.
That's beautiful. Venice is not a dangerous destination, but you have been to very dangerous destinations. Yeah. You mentioned the nuclear sites, the Bikini Atoll, or you go to the northernmost part of Greenland. You seem fearless to me, but are you frightened of something? What frightens you?
I mean, I'm an optimistic guy, so I would say maybe nothing, but eventually I'm quite frightened about what is coming up and what the future is actually going to bring to us, because we still think from our comfort zone, even though this comfort zone or like this stable reality is becoming more and more erratic, and we're not that fast to actually recalibrate and find like new tools in order to cope with the reality and the world we're living in, which is changing at a pace which is really frightening. And us as a species in our genome, we're really used to stability. We're here because it was stable for 10,000 years, right? And that's something which I'm quite afraid of, because there is no solution yet. I mean, and we are heading with high velocity against the wall.
Does your art look for solutions for our problems?
No, actually not exactly. I think that to find solution as an artist is very difficult. I mean, I can address problem, I can question the way we handle thing. I mean, I can deconstruct some of like the bits and pieces which constitute the reality we are actually going through, but it's very difficult as an artist to really, solve like problem on this scale. And I also don't think that that should be the aim. Obviously, I'm doing what I can do. And I think that, well, this show here at the Langen Foundation, that's quite a good example, because it's a show about combustion, it's a show about energy, energy landscape, energy production. And basically, you will see once you get that the little pool, which is in front of the museum, and which is kind of this iconic view of the Langen Foundation, brought a huge container. And this container is open. And when it's open, it's deploying a full solar array. It's called a solar tainer, and it's developed by a company called Africa Green Tech. And actually, I bought this container together with Konstantin Schwab, a philanthropist and friend of mine, and we place it in front of the museum, blocking the view of the museum, and it will produce the electricity during the show. So the show is solar powered. At least in summer and winter, we will have to get part from the grid, part from the solar tainer. And the solar tainer, after the show, will be donated to a community in Namibia, which is working at the edge of the Kalahari Desert for black rhino conservation, which really need electricity. So this is like one example. And then also together with the Langen Foundation, we're doing a complete carbon calculation of the show, just to know what to make a show this scale mean. And we also donate actually a certain amount of money in order to buy the rights of mining, and I mean like all the rights about like deforestation, mining and so on, of 11,700 hectares of primordial cloud forest in Peru. And that we did with an association which is called Art into Acres. And that means also that the show have like another life somewhere else, which will continue after its end. And it's an interesting cloud forest because of some of the species which are in the Pancronic Garden are also there. And you know, like just being able to protect 11,000 hectares of cloud forest, well, for me was just amazing. So I'm very happy about that. And that also means that, like, you know, it's a show, but then the show is not only commenting on the reality, is also, you know, I don't want just to comment, I also want to act. And that was a way to actually continue the idea of the show, but in a very concrete way.
If time travel were real, what time and place would you visit?
Right now, the Carboniferous woodland.
When was that?
That's 280 million years ago.
Wow. What is your most important tool?
That's a difficult one. It's probably my smartphone.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
I'd be a bird.
What is your favorite color?
It's probably blue, but just a certain type of blue, like a deep electrical blue, you know, just before the thunderstorm when you are in the equatorial region. You know, this really deep, thick blue that you can almost touch.
Do you have a recurring dream?
Not really, no.
Do you listen to music while you work?
Yes, but not always, because music, I love music, but eventually is also taking a lot of my concentration. It depends which type of work, but I listen to music.
What kind of music would it be?
It can be everything, but I'm listening quite a lot to electronic music, but I'm not like, I'm pretty broad in what I can listen.
What topic would you like to see an entire issue of Weltkunst?
I think you should make a topic about biodiversity.
And last question, can you share a wisdom?
Yeah, I guess I can. That's more of a hiking wisdom. Down is optional, up is mandatory.
Very nice. Thank you, Julien. Thank you so much for taking the time, and it was great talking to you. Weltkunst, was macht die Kunst, wird Ihnen in Zusammenarbeit mit Christie's präsentiert. Das 50-jährige Bestehen Christie's Deutschland fand 2021 statt und 2022 bietet weitere Möglichkeiten, außergewöhnliche Kunst und Objekte zu entdecken. Besuchen Sie christies.com und erfahren Sie mehr über das weltweit führende Auktionshaus seit 1766. Auktion, Privatverkauf, online, Kunst jederzeit.